there's ripple effects into the present, right? Where like, what constitutes a nice cuppa? What constitutes a soothing cup of tea is this particular kind of dark, malty, black tea bag, right? Brewed with milk that kind of punctuates the day, right? It punctuates the day in for all sorts of various reasons.
Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. With me is Sarah Besky, Associate Professor in the Departments of International and Comparative Labor and Labor Relations, Law, and History in the ILR School at Cornell. She's the author of The Darjeeling Distinction, Labor and Justice on Fair Trade Tea Plantations in India, and Tasting Qualities, The Past and Future of Tea, the second and most recent of which she is here to talk to us about today. Sarah, welcome to Science for the People.
Thanks for having me.
So I do want to hear a little bit about your background and your interest in tea before we dive into some of the topics in the book. So where did that come from?
Sure. So I'm a cultural anthropologist. And so what I do in terms of research is I listen to the stories and the lives of people and kind of use that as the kind of the key fodder for what kind of constitutes my so-called data, my research. And so I'm just captivated. I'm captivated and curious about kind of the lives behind everyday things, like the stuff we take for granted, kind of the commodities that punctuate our lives, right? So in the case of things that we consume, coffee, tea, chocolate, rubber, bananas, right? These are commodities that kind of come to us from, kind of have these long colonial histories that come to us from fundamentally unequal, production systems in terms of the plantation. And so, I came to thinking about tea and thinking about tea in a particular place in the world, right? So this little, strip of India that kind of sticks up, between Nepal and Bhutan. So Darjeeling for tea drinkers out there. This kind of famed, tea growing area. And so I came to think about tea, wondering about all these kind of certification, these labels that affix themselves to the packages of tea that we consume, like what they meant for workers. And so that's been a long kind of, concern of my research. But what kind of brought me to the particular subject of the book we'll be talking about is, to kind of think about all of the work and all of the kind of scientific, economic, social, like kind of put a bunch of adjectives in front of it, kind of forms of work that go into creating value of these seemingly everyday, super boring commodities like tea. So that's kind of, my vantage point for looking at, something like tea and the industrial science around, tea production and tea quality.
So I think a lot of people, when they think about anthropology, they have a tendency to kind of cross streams a little bit with archaeology and think about people studying artifacts and cultures of the past. But there's a lot of anthropology that is studying current cultures and current systems. And obviously, one of the benefits of studying something that is happening and alive right now is you can go and live among it and experience it in a way that obviously we can't when we're trying to study and understand something that's long in the past. And it was clear from this book that you have spent a lot of time living and working and talking to people in these areas, which is really cool. Is that fairly typical of anthropologists studying kind of living systems?
Absolutely. And so for those of you who are interested, right, there's four, like in a kind of Americanist anthropology or North Americanist anthropology, there are four kind of subfields of anthropology, right? Archaeology is one of those. Cultural anthropology, which is what I'm doing, which is the kind of the lovely introduction you just gave to cultural anthropology, which is an attention to the problems of the present. But there's also two other fields, right, which is linguistic anthropology, right? So this very kind of super fine grained detail into the language that kind of punctuates and kind of makes life make sense. And then biological anthropology, right? So, which is often also kind of the thing that many people associate with anthropology, right? Like things like bones. But that being said, yes, like I think this is a key method for cultural anthropologists to kind of to be in a place and to not necessarily go in with a hypothesis to prove, right? So I think methodologically what sets anthropology apart and why I believe firmly in it as a methodology is it's not a hypothesis kind of testing program. We kind of listen to the stories of the people we're working with, of the people we're living with, and kind of try to understand what's important to them. What do they, right, want us to think with, and what do they want us to kind of pay attention to if we're thinking about, say, tea in India or any suite of social problems that that a potential researcher could be looking at. And I think that it's a subtle shift, but it's a really powerful shift to kind of really be attentive to what people say that they are interested in talking about, what people, the idioms and frameworks that, say is what a researcher should pay attention to, as opposed to going in with a set of questions that they're trying to answer and kind of getting out, right? So methodologically, a lot of what I do and a lot of what other cultural anthropologists do is a method called participant observation, right? This may be kind of familiar to you, but right. So it's not just observation and it's not just participation, right? It's participation and observation at the same time. So in the case of my first book on kind of tea work, right, the work of women workers on tea plantations in the Darjeeling district of West Bengal, I kind of followed workers as they worked in the field, right? I plucked tea with workers. I tried to kind of understand phenomenologically, so to speak, like learning while doing, what it meant to work on a plantation, right? And I'm never going to have that same positionality of a tea worker, but it's a kind of a path to understanding the lives of others through doing and seeing and thinking and being and using the language. That's really also quite important, right? To use the language with which the people you work with speak. And so, in the case of the book at hand, right? So I spent a lot of time learning how to taste tea, learning with tea tasters, sitting in auction rooms in Kolkata, in this big urban center in India, right? Looking through auction catalogs, sitting with tea buyers as they hour after hour after hour tried to buy tea. And so, yes, what sets anthropology apart, what is exciting to me as a method and like what I love teaching students about is this method of participant observation. And it's kind of key to how I do what I do.
Here's a question that I cannot honestly believe I've never asked before, but as you were answering the last one, I realized that I actually don't really know, and I'm not sure I could describe it. What is the difference between cultural anthropology and sociology?
Oh, I think you would get a lot of different answers depending on who's answering them. And there's especially kind of from the vantage point of being in the U.S. In particular, right? There's a pretty there's been a historically kind of firmly drawn line in the sand, for better or for worse. I'm not saying this is actually the case anymore, but historically, right? That sociologists study the United States, right, study kind of the society of the place that the researcher themselves is a part of, and then anthropologists study places far away. This distinction has been firmly broken down over time, right, such that there's a lot of, I mean, sociologists who work outside of the United States, and there's a lot of anthropologists that work within the United States. So that's not a productive distinction anymore, but I think that many kind of like part of the genealogy of these disciplines is rooted in this geographical distinction. But there's also, again, methodological distinctions. Again, just like there's cultural anthropologists really kind of employ in participant observation, long-term ethnographic work. There's a lot of sociologists that do ethnographic work too, wherever it may be. But maybe what does set something like sociology apart is a much larger suite of methods, right, that include the more quantitative that often is not the case for anthropology, or at least cultural anthropology. So yeah, that's maybe just a quick and dirty answer. But depending on what you're looking at, depending on what you're studying, depending on what kind of methods you're employing, that difference is very, very, very blurry.
Yeah, I can see how it definitely would be blurry, and probably depending on where you are and what time you are studying, which one, it probably gets more or less blurry depending on where you are in those different axes.
Totally.
So I do definitely want to talk about tea, and I also want to talk about quality. But before we get into a deep dive on some of the ideas around quality, I think we probably need to unpack some of the history of tea, because this is, I think to understand the quality of tea, we really have to understand first the history a little bit. So can you talk a little bit about the origin of tea, kind of where it first came from and how the production of it came to India, and a little bit of the baggage around tea production in India?
Yes. And so we could be here for hours, but I'll try to give you the most succinct version. And right, so kind of long history of tea. Tea is primarily grown extensively in East Asia, right? China, Japan. There are indigenous production practices and consumption practices in northeastern India prior to British colonization. However, right, the kind of the vast production system that we see with regard to Indian and kind of South Asian more broadly, right, including Sri Lanka, East African production too, this is all kind of a function of British colonialism. And so kind of how tea came to India first and then later these other colonial contexts is, unsurprisingly, a white British colonist kind of clandestinely took tea seeds from Southwest China and planted them in northeast India. And so there's some really brilliant, beautiful environmental historical work about this colonial project of trying to grow this Chinese botanical stock in northeast India, and these kind of plant hybridization projects between this local indigenous variety of tea, right? It's a Camellia osmensis versus Camellia sinensis, right? The Chinese jat or Chinese variety of tea, and the Assam or Indian variety of tea, right? Kind of hybridizing these two plants to kind of make it succeed in northeast India. And along with that, right, is the conscription and indenture of hundreds of thousands of people to work on that project, right, to work in these plantations in northeast India. And so as the British annexed more lands from the independent kingdom of Sikkim, the independent kingdom of Bhutan, on these newly annexed lands, often through very policies that deemed indigenous Swidden lands as waste, this kind of facilitated the quite easy opening up of plantations by colonial agents and colonial settlers, and so that's kind of there's this kind of metastasizing growth of tea plantations, first in India, then in Sri Lanka, right, colonial Ceylon, and then in East Africa. And this is kind of the space that I kind of spend most of my time thinking with, right? So there's a pretty significant distinction in the market and in terms of like the actual botanical stuff that you see in front of you between the East Asian market and kind of the now post-colonial kind of situation, right? In India, Sri Lanka, and East Africa, right? And these are the producers of the stuff that we kind of readily call black tea. And the stuff that kind of appears in our English breakfast and our Irish breakfast and whatever your preferred, blended tea bag is. I think the thing that does set the East Asian situation and kind of the South and South Asian and East African situation apart is the existence and persistence of the plantation. Tea is like black tea is kind of brought to you, more often than not by virtue of the plantation and the plantation as this system that delivers kind of a regularly tasting and standardized product, but is, but the effects of that for workers are kind of low wages, minimal mobility, and very, very precarious land tenure arrangements, right, in terms of property arrangements with regard to their ability and their rights to the soil and to their houses. So I'll just leave it at that.
Can you also talk a little bit about how tea is grown and produced? Because there are things like wheat that are highly mechanized. We have big trucks that plant wheat and harvest wheat, that kind of thing. There's things like coffee. There's things like wine. And I think there's some specifics around tea as a thing that is grown and the bits of the plant that we use that give tea some particular requirements when it comes to production that maybe we don't see in things like coffee or wheat.
Totally. And so what makes tea really quite interesting as compared to something like coffee is that it is not an annual harvest or like wine, right? It is plucked nearly continuously, right? So every week or more or so, 10, 11, even 12 months a year, depending on where you are in the world, right? And every week, that is a different kind of, there's a kind of difference to how that tea tastes. But kind of backing up in terms of production process, right? So imagine kind of a huge monoculture, right? A huge farm, right? That is completely covered in tea bushes. And tea bushes are kind of cut and pruned into these, like, think about like maybe the boxwoods outside of someone's house, right? They're pruned and into these like dense little bushes, right? They're about waist high, and they're pruned such that the top of the bush is super flat, right? To allow for what is called a plucking shelf, right? And so what workers are doing is if you can kind of put your thumb and your forefinger together, they're breaking off with both hands in kind of this very rhythmic fashion. What's kind of termed two leaves and a bud. So the first two leaves of the youngest sprigs of this bush and the little bud before it's kind of turned into a full leaf. That's what women are kind of, are plucking, and they're plucking these leaves and throwing them into their basket. And so from first thing in the morning until the late afternoon, this is the labor process of plucking. And so then once these kind of these buckets and buckets of tea are plucked, they're sent to the factory, and the factory is on the plantation, generally speaking, for processing. And processing is this, mechanized process, but the machines are often the very same ones that have been in the factory since, the late 1800s, that first wither the plant, right, to wither these tea leaves to get some of the residual moisture out. Then they're fermented, really oxidized, right, such that the green leaf turns brown, right? So imagine just picking any leaf off of a tree, right, and through this process, right? So it kind of turns brown, like an apple turns brown when it sits on your counter. So once the leaves kind of turn brown, then they're rolled. And so again, imagine that kind of that leaf you just plucked off a tree, putting it between your palms and rolling it until it comes into a little kind of like, twist or a ball. And then it gets fired, right? Which is like this kind of conveyor belt style, baker. It cooks out some of that moisture, and then it's sorted, right? And so imagine kind of something like a can of mixed nuts in which, you shake your can of mixed nuts and the Brazil nuts go to the top and the peanuts go to the bottom, right? Something kind of similar is done with, tea. So imagine that can of mixed nuts, where you kind of shake the can of mixed nuts and the Brazil nuts go to the top and the peanuts go to the bottom. A similar kind of machine shakes tea such that, the large twists kind of, are separated from the broken leaf. And the leaf size are the grades of tea, right? So full leaf, tea is graded higher than smaller broken leaves of tea. And what's interesting to me, right, as an anthropologist, is that there's a pretty stark division of labor on the plantation around these kind of field-based and factory-based production systems, right? Anything that's kind of done with your hand is done by women, and anything that's done with a machine is done by men, right? And so that machine can actually, filters into the plant, into the plantation field as well, right? So like, men are the workers who wear like these backpack pesticide sprayers, right? So that's kind of think about that as a kind of machine, right? It's not done fully with your hand. But the sorting process, which is done with this, which is still kind of filtered through the hands of women, again, is that the women start plucking the tea and they end the production process by sorting the tea once it comes out of the sorting machine. So that's kind of just a long view from kind of bush to a big bag of tea that then goes kind of down to the to these auction houses in Calcutta, where it's then kind of auctioned off to any number of buyers around the world.
So this is where the journey of tea for me started to completely go off any of my assumptions about what tea was. I had some sense of what tea was. I had some sense of how it was produced. I had no idea about tea auctions and tea brokers. And I would love for you to give us another one of those excellent overviews to kind of allow people to wrap their heads around this part of the industry, which is fascinating.
It is totally fascinating. And when I started working on tea, right, started working on the plantations and in the fields, I knew nothing about the tea auction as well. I kind of had, and I started kind of hearing about it as something, right, fair trade at the time was something that was really, really hot in places like Darjeeling and in tea kind of generally. And fair trade was this project that tried to circumvent the auction house. And so I kind of only knew about it as a place that was circumvented. But when I went to the auction system, it was just totally fascinating. And the auction system is as old as the plantation itself in India. And actually it predates the plantations in India, right? There was these East India Company auctions, right, set up in the 1700s and even earlier, that auctioned this whole suite of commodities that the East India Company had kind of extracted from various parts of the world in London. And then once after kind of these tea plantations started developing in India, right, beginning in the 1830s and really after the 1850s, in 1861, the first tea auction opened up in Kolkata. And tea auctioning is, it's a process that links tasting to the actual selling of tea. So that big bag of tea that was just sorted from a plantation is shipped down to a brokerage firm in Kolkata, right? And there's actually 7 different auction centers in India. So the same thing would happen in any of those other 7 auction centers. But that bag of tea gets sent down to a broker that the plantation owner, plantation management kind of contracts with to sell their tea. And the broker tastes these lots of tea. So remember, right, it's really important, the kind of ecological kind of variation of tea, right, that sets it apart from coffee or wine. Every week or so, women are kind of going back to the same kind of part of the plantation to pluck it, and then that's being processed. So a plantation, really, even one singular plantation every week is sending multiple multiple samples of tea down to their broker. And there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of plantations across even just the northeast part of India. So just kind of imagine the numerical, the bigness of the number, right? The numerical diversity of stuff that these brokers are dealing with. And so the broker then sets it up in these kind of, these long, like narrow tables. The tasting rooms of these brokerage houses, are these long, narrow tables. And in front of the broker, who's the taster, there is dried tea. There is wet tea, right? So steep tea, like once if you kind of put your tea in a teapot and steeped it and then dumped it out, right? That wet tea, and then the actual brewed tea. And so each tea, right? So hundreds and hundreds of teas are in front of them. They taste the tea. They look at the wet leaves. They smell the wet leaves. They look at the dry leaves. They smell the dry leaves. And they use this very controlled vocabulary that was actually codified in 1938. And it's still in use today, right? To describe the teas, and they use this controlled vocabulary, and then they kind of send those commentaries back to the plantation with a justification of how they're valuing that particular lot of tea. And they use this kind of controlled valuation lexicon, and they set a valuation price, and that valuation price is then circulated to the registered buyers of the tea auction, right? And so, and they do this lot by lot by lot. And so that happens. So this is, say this is week one, 3 weeks later, that very same tea that the broker tasted comes up for auction. And think about an auction just like that. Maybe you've been to a furniture auction or some Chotsky auction somewhere at some point in your life. It's, you know, there's something kind of familiar about the format of an auction, right? There's lots, and one by one, they come up for sale. And so that same broker who tasted the tea then goes downstairs to this big auction room, like a lecture, like a university lecture hall, 3 weeks later. And then one by one, in the same order that he, and it's often a he, and I can elaborate on that, tasted it, he then sells these lots of tea to buyers who are sitting in front of him at a lecture hall, calling out prices. And these buyers too have tasted that very same tea and have come to the auction room with, kind of their max prices, right? They know what in advance they're kind of willing to buy. And everyone kind of knows what plantation this is coming from, when it was produced, the general grade, but they also know the kind of taste of the tea, right? And like, they know what it looks like, what it smells like, what the wet leaves look like, what the dry leaves look like. Those are all really important factors, right? It's not just quality, is not just the taste of tea, right? The kind of flavor notes. It's this kind of whole package, because most of the tea that, you know, most consumers kind of encounter is blended, right? So 20 to 30 different kinds of different lots of tea, right, as they appear at the auction, go into a singular blend of tea. It doesn't matter how expensive that blend of tea is, the cheapest tea, the most expensive tea, they're often all, right? So yes, there are single lots of single origin teas, but they're often, more times than not, tea is blended. And no matter what the price point is, those blends are kind of working for different markets, right? Blenders are blending with an eye to the hardness or softness of the water in a particular market, the kinds of milk that people may or may not use with that tea, right? So there's a lot that goes into buying. And it's this, for me as an anthropologist, it is this process that is fully mediated by, right, the body of these professional tea brokers, who both taste tea and sell it, right? So auction it off. So that's kind of what the auction, and then, so from the auction, then it goes on to, small, like super family, like small family business type blending agencies in India. The people sitting at the auction are buying, are proxy buyers for any number of international interests. And so after the auction, it can kind of go into any kind of corner of the world, really, for consumption there.
The tea auctions, the outcry tea auctions in particular, are so fascinating, and the culture around tea brokers. And it's definitely something you get into in depth in the book when you talk about this process of selling and buying tea is mediated through a tea broker. It's a particular type of person who is tasting tea, who, like you say, is using a very specific vocabulary that is very specific to tea, and is specific to tea within the idea of selling tea. Because we think about like the language of wine or the language of coffee. We all know that wine people can use all this sort of specific wine language to talk about the flavors in wine. It's fruity, it's acidic, it's whatever. Mm-hmm. But the words that you talk through in the book and that are used by these tea brokers are not general terms that we as tea aficionados would use. They are so hyper specific to the particular task that tea brokers are doing in order to tease apart this kind of subjective but yet somehow rigorous definition of value.
Totally. The language used to describe tea is just totally, totally fascinating. And it was actually, I mean, thinking about maybe like some of the things that your listeners are interested in, it was really kind of codified and regimented from a push by scientists within the industry, because scientists would kind of show up at these auctions in the 1920s and the 1930s and be completely dumbfounded because every broker, right? So this process that I just described of like tea coming to the brokerage house, it gets tasted, it gets sold, right? It's been going on pretty much like unchanged since 1861. So in the 1920s, 1930s, scientists working within the industry, right? There's a huge kind of suite of industrial science. Scientists are just totally confused because all these brokers at the time were using this totally idiosyncratic language. Like an individual broker would just kind of describe tea the way, you know, that they felt most appropriate and send those comments back to the plantation. And planters would complain to these industrial scientists that they had no idea how to react to these kind of quality concerns raised by the brokers. And so scientists kind of got with the brokers and they got with the kind of plantation owners to work to standardize the language of tea selling. And yes, totally, as you point out, this is a language that does not circulate outside of the space of the auction and the plantations, right? This is a language that looks back from the brokerage house to the plantations. It does not go from the brokerage house to kind of points towards consumption in the commodity chain. And that language of the language of consumption is, yeah, it's totally whatever the tea retailer honestly wants to use, right? There is, and it is very much kind of implicated in kind of fancifulness and the sensory kind of qualities of these kind of luxurious qualities of wine words. And there's not that kind of luxury in tea words, right? So tea words are things like biscuity and knobbly and cheesy and wiry. Cheesy teas don't taste like cheese at all. They're actually, it's a taint, right? It's an aberration in terms of how tea was shipped. Minty too. Minty teas do not taste like mint at all. Also a problem, that was I talk a lot about the book, it's not necessarily bad and good qualities, but it's a kind of aberrant quality inflicted, right, as tea kind of moves from the plantations to the auction houses, right? It can get kind of over moist and it can get this kind of funky taste. And that funky taste is a minty tea. And novelty teas, right? You can kind of imagine like a log, you know, sitting out in the woods somewhere with this kind of knob in it, right? So those kind of knobs exist on long twists of tea, right? That's a novelty tea. Blackish, brownish, the way that something that tea looks when it's not just steeped and it's steeped as a black tea, but when milk is poured within it and kind of steeped with milk, the degree of its pinkness. These are all concerns that brokers kind of use this lexicon to kind of indicate. And it's about 150 words, and it's really kind of, it's very specific. It's very unchanged. And importantly, it's often in the case of minty and cheesy, right? Those are taints. Those I think are like outliers. It's often not about goods and bads, right? Quality. One of the things that I'm kind of so interested about, it's not that the same way that, you know, we often talk about quality as consumers, right? There's good quality and there's bad quality. It's like, no, quality here is this descriptive process, right? Because tea, as a broker sees it, is never going to kind of, or an individual tea is never going to be consumed, often never going to be consumed by itself. It's going to be consumed within conjunction of, with, you know, these 20 to 30 other teas in a blend. And so it's the qualities of that tea. It's color, it's taste, it's smell, that this lexicon kind of gets at, for plantation owners and often for brokers as a kind of inter auction language to kind of go with, to accompany these numerical valuation prices. So that's the kind of lexicon for tea, for the tea auction.
It's such a fascinating lexicon because it is made up of what appear to be innocuous taste terms. So it clearly comes from a, I don't want to say less rigorous, but it comes clearly from using words that are color words to describe something visually or taste words. But they're now have become so specific, as you mentioned, sometimes just about like, they really mean that something about the processing is not quite right, or it's like a piece of feedback or criticism back around the particular time that things were plucked or the particular way they were wilted or rolled. Like, it's so fascinating to get a little glimpse in some of the history of how a language like that can take some language that, you know, I understand, I sort of have a sense of what biscuity might mean, and I would be curious to know if that is even close to what it actually means in tea, and probably it's not, but it's that idea of familiar language being suddenly unfamiliar lingo.
That's a really beautiful way to put it, right? These are like on the surface, if like you kind of read these words, as you know, right? And you didn't look at the definition, like you'd be like, I think I know what that means. Like a stewy tea, like stewy is a great word, right? Stewy, right? You can imagine a stewy tea to be like dark and sumptuous, right? And like it has this like, you know, this viscosity to it. No, right? Like not at all, right? It means that it was like, the firing temperature was wrong, right? And that it's a little too burnt, right? It's like almost in a way the total bang opposite of what you would think something stewy would mean, where it'd be like moist and delicious. I think that's step back for a minute and like there's actually, and this is like it gets at this relationship between science or industry and language, right? How do you convey without some you know numerical scale, right? Because numerical scales are not necessarily better or anything, right? How do you convey that something has too much or too little moisture in it, right? Without just like, what's, you know, to say that something has too much moisture, like, well, how much is too much, right? Versus to say it's a stewy tea, or it's blackish, or it's, right, it's overfired. Right. So it's this kind of resistance of too much, too little, good, bad. It's this kind of, the using of seemingly understandable words to kind of get at, to get at relative values, that I think that without just saying, not just taking a super finite number of words and kind of saying this is this much blackish or this much brownish or this much pinkish or this, you know, it has this many knobs on it, right? So the quality language is this beautifully unquantified form, right? The valuation price is the quantitative. The linguistic is this qualitative form of value.
And it's also not entirely focused on just the taste of the tea. As you mentioned, they're also looking very carefully at the tea, and there's some of the language that is about what the tea looks like.
Oh, totally. And that's hugely important to a blender, and it's hugely important to the value of a tea, right? The numerical value of a tea, like the price of a tea, right? Because so much, like, so maybe like you and I and like some of your listeners, right? Most of the time we experience tea, we would like put it in a tea bag, like we pour some hot water in it, and we never look at it again until we throw it in the trash bag. But like for many consumers across the world, the way that a tea looks when it's wet is, you know, incredibly important to how a consumer kind of engages with its value, right? Because a lot of people drink blended tea, but it comes in a kind of a plastic packet that you boil with water, right? So in the case of India, right? So the production and consumption of chai, right? This, you put it in a saucepan, with some hot water, with some milk, with some spices, depending on where you are regionally in India, that milk changes. Obviously the water hardness and softness changes, the spices that you prefer, you know, varies within region, but it varies within households. But the way that then you see that wet leaf is, it's part of the experience of tea, right? And therefore it is part of the way that these brokers value tea. So, So yeah, the way that a tea looks when it's both wet and dry is key, because if you're buying kind of bulk tea, or you're buying tea in that kind of mass market packet of tea, you see it as it's when it's dry. And so something that is quite, you know, attractive to many buyers in like these kind of, or what, you know, tea buyers told me is attractive to buyers, especially in middle class markets in India, are little kind of flecks of greenness, right, that are kind of imparted from particular Darjeeling teas, right? So a little greenish tea is itself, right, on its own, maybe not something that's necessarily desirable, but in a blend, the dry leaf produces this particular aesthetic quality that is desirable in some consumer markets.
Okay. I definitely want to start. We've already started a bit, but I want to really dig into this idea of quality, because that is a theme that from the very beginning of the book to the very end is something you are constantly focused on and constantly thinking about and trying to tease apart. And so I think probably the place to start is to just try and unpack the word quality a whole bunch. I mean, it's an everyday word. I use it, you use it, all the listeners use it probably at least once a day, but it can mean a whole lot of different things.
Totally. And like, I didn't set out to study quality. Quality was like something that I started to kind of see as part of the everyday language of the, of various kind of actors in the industry, but in a very different way than, like, as you know, that we kind of use it, right? In kind of popular, you know, Euro-American parlance, right? The vernacular. Quality is weirdly this quantitative relationship, right? Things have more quality, things have less quality, right? Item, right? It's used as a particular kind of adjective. And when it's used as a particular kind of adjective, it kind of connotes, this more or lessness. And then in kind of, you know, intellectual debates and kind of anthropological and kind of broader social science debates, you know, in the last 20 years, there's a super huge attention to various consumer products that are not the kind of big mass market items, or these artisanal products. And this kind of, this turn in research, this turn in publications and in production, right, to things like local heritage pork, to artisanal cheese, to, you know, super expensive French wine. This attention to artisanal products has been kind of labeled within, in terms of anthropological and social science discourse as a quality turn, right? This quality turn in attention in food studies. And so kind of, but quality is, In industrial terms and in terms of like the both historical and contemporary ways that I saw tea brokers and in particular use quality, is quality is not this like more or less than proposition. Quality as a noun is this super open plane that is completely conditioned by regional concerns, by desire, by any sort of number of consumerist concerns that make quality this completely open-ended thing, right? There is not good quality. There is not bad quality. Because even if a tea, say, for example, you know, it has, you know, a little, you know, it has this, you know, particular kind of taint, it's still drinkable. But its price is really low. And so therefore, like, you could put that tea in a blend with some other teas, and it reduces the average price of that blend. And everybody is happy. So that itself isn't devoid of quality. It itself has qualities. Minty is a quality. It is not a less than quality. The way that then quality was used and worked on in that frame was super fascinating to me. But then the other kind of layer is looking kind of both in the present and in the past, as I can tend to do in my work. I was fascinated by how quality was the object of analysis for much industrial reform. Like, so the quality of, I described the outcry auction system, but in the last few years, right, the outcry auction system, where people are sitting in these auction rooms, right, these lecture halls, like bidding out prices with their voices, has pretty much gone dormant, right? It doesn't exist anymore, because it's been replaced with a computerized form of trading. And I can talk about that more, but what's important is that the why that transition happened from outcry to digital trading is the Tea Board of India, right? The government regulator of the tea industry wanted to make the market, right? They wanted to work on the quality of economic interactions. And they, like, the government used quality in this particular way because, like, the economic, the interactions, like the exchange interactions at the auction house were something that they did, they wanted to be of a different kind of quality, right? And they wanted the bodies of these brokers to have different kinds of quality. And the quality was this animating concern. But then also, right, throughout the kind of early 1900s, right, attention to, what quality is and what distinguishes Indian tea from Ceylon tea, from East African tea, was this concern of tea scientists as well. And so quality came to be this organizing, kind of concept in the book is it's because it's this thing that's kind of always worked on, but is not necessarily something that, kind of comes to the fore in popular accounts of the tea industry, right? Popular accounts of the tea industry, popular accounts of any industry are, right, there's luxury bourgeois consumption that is high quality, and then there's cheap mass market things that are low quality. And, you know, my read on the auction is, it's certainly in the working with brokers, is that brokers do not think that that things that happen to be low priced or low quality at all. And so just kind of undoing this seemingly, you know, oversimplistic dynamic between expensive, good quality, cheap, low quality, right? Quality is not particularly, maybe useful in that kind of spectrum.
After reading the book, it's clear to me that there is this really interesting intersection of tea and the idea of quality, where, as you say, there's an idea of quality that we think of colloquially as being something is better than or less than, whereas a lot in tea, it's not really a judgment on overall better than or overall less than. It's really about there are different types of things about tea that different people in different places in different blends will find useful or not useful. So here they are, pick the things that are useful for you or that are tasty to you. And then there's also this idea of quality that comes into the story of tea, where it's people trying to more firmly either impose or utilize or prompt this idea of a hierarchical quality on tea, in particular to the public, that does try and like push tea as being this type of tea is definitely better than this type of tea. And sometimes it's around, I mean, there's a large controversy around tannins, whether or not, that was good for tea, that has a whole topic of quality, but there's also a lot of colonial and racist tension when we think of the word quality. I mean, there's a whole portion of history where a quality tea was had connotations of the kind of mechanistic production where someone's unclean hands didn't touch my tea. That had very, like, hugely problematic issues with what quality tea was at that time or was defined more broadly. So it's interesting that tea really embodies both this kind of almost non-hierarchical structure of quality, but also at times a very hierarchical structure of quality.
Totally. I mean, so the if you kind of take this, you know, snippet of looking at the lexicon, which we talked about, quality is this descriptive project, right? It's describing, it's fully describing things in this non-quantitative way. But yes, like historically, this is kind of like one of these things that really interests me in thinking about things, both in the present and the past. As, right, these plantations grew in India, as Indian tea as a thing in the world became something that's showing up on, you know, people's tables in the UK as something that is called Indian tea, right? Right. Tea, you know, prior to that had been kind of really thought of as what was Chinese tea, right? It was something that came from China, right? It had a lighter color. It had these particular qualities. And so when, so consumers, were kind of confused by the super, you know, this darker, slightly more tannic, and I'll talk about tannins in a second, more kind of multi-thick beverage than this, the Chinese tea. And so the blending as a thing in the world kind of arose at this, with the growth of the Indian, South Asian, and later East African kind of tea industries, to kind of blend out difference, to try to blend together Chinese tea or East Asian tea and Indian and other South Asian teas, right? To kind of get to a more standardized form so that it wasn't, such this kind of different product. And right. But yes. And exactly, as you said, like this, there was these, you know, these super, you know, these questions about what was, more quality in terms of Chinese tea versus Indian tea that were not about the tea itself, but about the labor process and about the relative values of Chinese workers over Indian workers and the relative cleanliness, the relative purity, these really racialized notions that steeped into tea itself. Whether the plantation, and what was actively marketed was the plantation was this, hierarchical, scientific, super Euro, this European, form of controlling, controlling this unknown colony, right? That the plantation was the means by which difference in the form of Indian racialized labor became palatable. Right. So like by virtue of like, you know, Lipton's ads, if you kind of look at them, are this kind of, you know, comely, woman, Indian woman stooped or Sri Lankan woman stooped, kind of presenting a white woman tea, right? Kind of the narrative of these ads is that Lipton's plantations orders this colony, orders this difference to allow this tea to kind of come to consumers in a legible, understandable, and importantly safe in terms of food safety and ontologically safe, like safe as a thing that is in the world and that can sit alongside unproblematically all the other things I consume. So quality kind of percolates through all these discussions of difference of race and of the plantation itself. And so like for me as a kind of, right, the thing that kind of, that really animates a lot of my work and a lot of, you know, this particular project is to kind of understand how the plantation is really, really, really hard to break up in India, because the tea plantation and the tea auction are these institutions that kind of grew together. And, despite all the efforts to kind of, that I describe in the book in terms of trying to kind of reduce the power of brokers to maybe eventually get rid of the brokerage system, of the auction system in general, in favor of something perhaps more democratic, this institution is impossible to break up. And so too is the plantation. And one of the reasons why the plantation why the kind of auction needs the plantation and the plantation needs the auction is that the plantation kind of has come to produce what consumers and brokers and the lexicon kind of have come to normatively define as quality. Right. So things that are produced outside of the space of the plantation in these smallholder arrangements are thought to be, you know, are do not get valued at the same, at the same kind of price ranges. They, are thought to be kind of these teas that cannot produce the quality tea that is necessary for blends that buyers and blenders want. So kind of part of what animates me about quality as a political concern is that, the things like the consumers' expectations, right? The very ideas about how something is supposed to be, right? Normativity is like normative understandings about the quality and taste of black tea hold the plantation together, right? They have framed how it is thought, right, over the last several decades, and they kind of frame how tea continues to kind of be thought as a thing in the world.
It's very clear that quality or taste is defined kind of culturally, but also in the book, you give a couple of very clear examples of times and places where quality or preference for certain types of teas or qualities about the tea itself were created by industries or organizations. They were prompted, they were propagated throughout the world, or they were tried to fight against, as in when there was a push for people to drink more Indian tea rather than Chinese tea. There's both the idea of quality and tastes and preferences, especially where things are very subjective, like with taste, being kind of culturally, they exist culturally kind of with a life of their own, but also they are incredibly malleable at certain times and places by certain groups or organizations. So I'm left kind of trying to pick apart what is constructed kind of by accident and what is constructed by design.
Yeah. But why do you need to pull them apart?
That's a good question.
I mean, that's totally right on. But like this, like kind of deliberate and kind of, you know, ripple effect incidental are all in a way kind of part of the same project. Right. And you kind of, like what's kind of, you know, fun to, you know, or, you know, productive to kind of think about is the overt actions, right? The intended actions, right? This is the case for anything, right? Intended actions have unintended actions as well. I think there's something, you know, specific to, you know, your question too about, I mean, yes, like British imperial concerns in the UK, pushed what they termed empire tea, right? Tea grown in colonial Ceylon and colonial India in particular, right? Pushed this tea as empire tea on the market. They tried to kind of preferential trade agreements such to kind of keep out what was, you know, then Dutch grown tea in contemporary Indonesia from the market, right? Tried to make kind of consuming tea this nationalist project that kind of reified what made someone British, and right, and so like there's ripple effects into the present, right, where like what constitutes a nice cuppa, what constitutes a soothing cup of tea is this particular kind of dark, malty, black tea bag, right, brewed with milk that kind of punctuates the day, right? It punctuates the day in for all sorts of various reasons, right? It could be a really good thing that happened. It could be a really terrible thing that happened. But the tea is this, you know, European British, amelioration project for whatever it may be. And that was a kind of deliberate PR project. It was a deliberate colonial project to kind of make, Indian tea, to make kind of this black tea substance, something that, was part of everyday life in Britain.
I think one of the reasons my brain wants to pick it apart is because with subjective things that rely on taste, and I'm not just talking about the taste of a food or a beverage, but taste more aesthetically, whether it's a taste for a specific color or a type of clothing or whatever, I really found myself having to like actively consider the fact that the things that I think of as personal choices and personal tastes of mine, qualities that I personally like in things or flavors, beverages, food, are impossible for me to actually claim autonomously because oftentimes they are thrust upon me in kind of invisible ways, sometimes in my present, but sometimes also in the history behind me that has led to certain things being presented as this is what quality tea is. It was an interesting process to read the book and kind of actively try and actively be reminded of something I already knew, but I often don't think that deeply about, which is the amount of my own taste, preferences, and subjective experience of quality is not really my own autonomous experience. Does that make sense?
Totally, right on. Yes. Like, and also, like, what is fascinating about quality, maybe this resonates with your own experience, is like, it's you kind of, or like, or your taste, right, in that kind of, like, kind of generalized sense, is so wrapped up in what you or any of us kind of expect something to be, right? This previous kind of understanding of the thing itself, right? Yeah. How we like, and that kind of the supposed to be-ness is so central to what constitutes quality as it kind of circulates the world as a concept. And that's what's interesting to me.
And the moving target nature of it as well, because if we think about that, going back to the idea of, there was a period where the kind of mechanized nature of tea, in India being better than the kind of hand-picked mm-hmm. nature of tea in China. If I think now and put myself in a current headspace of, you know, 2020, if someone were to explain to me hand-picked tea, it sounds like it should be better. It should be higher quality tea. It makes it sound rarer and slower. And my assumption is if someone's doing that, it must be for a good reason. Like maybe it's going to make it taste better. And thinking about that at the same time, I think about what the kind of different definition we gave those things really makes me go, wow, human brains are dumb.
Yeah, it's this kind of, right, self-fashion, it's this culture, production, it's this knowledge production project, right? Knowledge is actively always produced. It does not exist in the world. And so knowledge about the tea, knowledge about whether something is supposed to be good or bad, whether hand-plucked versus mechanized is, and what their relative values are, that is kind of always being actively worked on, like everything else. And the thing is, the relative values of those things can kind of change and morph backwards and forwards over time, right? Such that we're in a kind of place now in 2020, right? Thinking about tea, where, right? So, call it 1900, right? There was this kind of consumer quandary over, whether less mechanized China produced tea versus more mechanized plantation Indian produced tea was better or worse, right? And kind of this, In the case of super mass consumption, right, the plantation kind of won out in that kind of respect. But we're sitting in 2020 where this kind of these labels about small farmers, about hand picked, about artisanal production, are really evocative, right? So much so that in India right now, right, the same tea board that has been regulating the brokerage houses is also actively promoting the extension of small grower, right? So non-plantation grown tea. But with this idea that it's supposed to be better than, right, the plantation, right? Because this is, people are, own their own land hypothetically, and like they're slightly more autonomous to kind of do with the boons of tea what they will. But it's not so simple because there's no kind of codified rates at which these small grower operations are being remunerated at. There's really no laws protecting these small growers. There's kind of this impulse to kind of produce as much tea as possible, as fast as possible. So, pesticides are being overused, but it's a small grower. It's less it's non-plantation. So, but it's not necessarily, better, right? So I think what's great is to kind of think about, the evocativeness of kind of simple categories in consumerist discourse, and maybe understand in kind of super, specific places at specific times, how those things kind of work and how they kind of fall apart.
Thinking about quality as well, we talked a little bit about quality and cheapness, and thinking about plantations, reading through some of the ways that the plantations are struggling, obviously the colonial history of plantations and how that impacts the present day life on them and the people who live and work on them, but also in some of the changing and trying to break that hold of plantations and brokerages, it leaves a bunch of people who are a part of that system kind of unaccounted for. And it reminds me that as we try and break out of systems that we think are no longer useful to us or negative in ways we want to try and escape from, there's always the challenge of how do we do that, but also protect the people who are part of those old systems? Because it's one thing to say the plantation should end, but it's a whole other thing to say, okay, but what about all the people who their families have lived on plantations and worked on plantations for years? And that is their livelihood. What happens to those people? They're not all going to go and become, you know, small tea farms somewhere.
Absolutely. And like, I mean, that's very much like, you know, really puts a fine point on kind of what's happening in India right now, is that there's this kind of growth of alternative, right? The growth of the alternative to the plantation, right? The expansion of these small grower arrangements for growing tea. But no plantations are getting reformed to give the land back to the workers. I mean, there's actually some hopeful examples in the Indian state of Tripura. Back up actually one second. In India, for the most part, especially in the north, you know, in the northeast and the Himalayan region where I work, that these plantations are very importantly owned deep down, right? They're owned by the state in which they sit, right? The land is owned by the state. So in the case of Darjeeling, owned by West Bengal, Assam, states in the northeast that have plantations, are owned by that state. And they're leased by plantation owners. And so in order to kind of really have large scale plantation reform, the state in India needs to, essentially divest themselves of this land, which hasn't happened. And so I think that kind of signals the entrenchment, say, of the plantation in India, but it also, it highlights how difficult it is to, even though how much activists or the most super well-meaning activists that know the obstacles that they're working with, to make alternatives for plantation workers, because the plantation right now in India is really, really, really difficult to break up. It is fixed in these very real legalistic land tenure economic kind of ways. And it's also kind of fixed because of the global demand and desire for what kind of constitutes normative quality tea. So even if workers are calling for this, activists are calling for this, you know, like well-meaning consumers are calling for changes to the plantation system, that is way, way, way easier said than done. Because of the way that these institutions are set up.
Yeah, it really feels like a chicken and egg problem, kind of profoundly chicken and egg. Like, where do you even start to influence that system to shift it in a direction that you want it? Because as you say, you've got an expectation and an industry that has an expectation as well as a huge volume. Like, let's not kid ourselves. There's a massive amount of tea and a demand for tea in the world. And that's not a thing that you can just change quickly. I mean, you can shift something like that. You can shift preferences, but it also is what it is. It's, you sort of have to work with the table as it's laid for you to some extent before you can start figuring out where the pieces should go.
Totally. I mean, and like the most radical, in terms of like change thing that could happen, right, is if there was like kind of a, this is kind of, you know, pie in the sky type thing, but like for both consumers and workers together in tandem to walk away from tea, to walk away from, you know, any number of probably exploitative, colonially rooted, consumption or commodities. The plantation persists because the demand persists. As that demand persists, so does the plantation. And that's, yes. So yes, there is this kind of chicken and egg, right? Like whatever the idiom is for to kind of understand this tension. But that's kind of the thing that's never really been thought is what would it mean to walk away from tea, even at independence in India, which is really, you know, which is really quite fascinating. Right. So there's, you know, all of these boards, all of these kind of commissions, study commissions that were formed in the super early 1950s to kind of study the industry, to kind of study the nationalization of Indian tea, for example. Never once was it asked, like, maybe we should just walk away from tea. Not that I'm saying like it should have, I mean, like, but I mean, it was never like, that was never a kind of a question that was asked. It was, how do we take this, this industry and make it, and make kind of, and boast and boost Indian consumption to make this industry more viable, right? How do we promote consumption to expand the industry, as opposed to kind of walk away from it? Full stop. And so now, yeah, so now we have this thing that, like, I just kind of keep coming back to this stuck with itness of something like the, like both the plantation and the auction system as these super intertwined systems.
And even walking away from tea, if we could get people on board with that being a solution, still has huge negative consequences for the people who, like lots and lots of people who rely on tea for their livelihoods, for their existence. So it's such a complicated thing because you feel like you both can't work with the table that's been set, but you also can't flip the table.
Absolutely. And like, and the plantation has created a system in which, or a situation in which workers have no rights to the land on which they live. They have no rights to their houses, right? These are all things, right? So everything on top of the soil is owned by the plantation owner, right? So they have, so even if, and this is what, you know, this is what makes when plantations upon occasion, kind of halt production, right? They become sick. They like kind of go into this like, temporary bankruptcy period. Workers, workers don't own that land. They can't rip up tea bushes and plant something else. Like this is, they are completely alienated from all the stuff around them. This is not theirs, right? So, and until there is a kind of massive land reforms project, like these questions about walking away or who, or what, you know, dear worker, what do you actually want to do? They cannot be, they cannot be asked because like land tenure has such that like it completely disempowers workers.
And we have definitely seen that around the world. It's certainly not unique to India. I'm originally from Canada. I live in the UK now, and I'm originally from Canada. And obviously, in North America and Australia and New Zealand, we see similar kinds of issues that are tied to who owns land.
Yes.
And on that note.
Totally. I mean, this is why, I love, you know, anthropology, right? Or I love, you know, or I love paying attention to the stuff that like often falls through the cracks, especially when it comes to kind of commodity studies or like the story of tea and the story of kind of fanciful luxury consumption is like super basic questions about, land, land rent, land tenure, wages, where people are getting their food from. These are the things that kind of fall out of the purview. I mean, bringing it back to questions of quality, fall it out of the purview of, you know, of contemporary discussions about consumer products, which really myopically often kind of focus on the taste of something. But the taste of something, good, bad, you know, floral, not floral, like whatever, is all implicated. It's all part of this larger project of the condition and the lives of the people who produce it. Yeah. So to kind of disaggregate those things is really, yeah, we need to kind of look at it holistically.
Yeah. And we often forget that. I mean, I think it's easier for us to remember that that's true when it comes to things we eat and drink. And we also need to remember that it's true of the physical products we use. Everything physical in the world requires some amount of land for it to come from. Something physical from the land, under the land, mixed by things or processed from ingredients that came from land, ultimately is needed to create every physical object.
Right on. Yes, totally. And like, and those things are also kind of like wrapped up in questions of desire and, you know, and like desire, or whatever it may be, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Sarah, it was a fascinating book. I learned so much about tea and a lot more about myself, actually, in a sort of weird way. And I highly enjoyed it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This was a really wonderful discussion.
And if you want to learn more about Sarah Besky or her book, Tasting Qualities, The Past and Future of Tea, as per usual, you can find links to click in the show notes for this episode, which you can find on our website, scienceforthepeople.ca. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Science for the People. Science for the People is listener-supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.